In the autumn of 1957, in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas, nine African-American teenagers were preparing to do something no one in their community had ever done before. They were about to make history by entering an all-white school.
Little Rock, Arkansas. The law of the land decrees integration, but racial feeling still runs high in the southern states of America. The law of the land is rejected.
The Little Rock Nine, as they would come to be known, had volunteered to integrate into the Little Rock Central High School after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling declared racial segregation in U.S. public schools to be unconstitutional.
But no sooner had they arrived than they were off again. Arkansas had evidently decided to make its own laws on the subject of integration.
One of those students was 15-year-old Melba Patillo Beals. She'd grown up in Little Rock, where all she knew was segregation. Now, 83 years of age, she's lived a life of education, activism and writing, a journey that began in the deeply segregated South. Earlier, she spoke to our reporter Colm Flynn about her experience, not just at Central High, but growing up in a world where everyday moments were marked by fear and exclusion.
The thing I remember most is going to the grocery store, and if we had groceries and somebody white came in, we had to step out of line. I remember once touching the potatoes, and I remember touching them, and this woman hit me on the head and called me an ugly name and said, if I touch the potatoes, nobody white would want to buy them. And it was a tremendous torture of one's self-esteem.
And Melba, when you were growing up as a young girl, did you understand what segregation was, or did you just think, well, this is the way it probably life is for everybody? Or
No. I did not understand what segregation was. I thought, they're calling us monkeys. They're saying we're ugly because we're black. Meanwhile, at home, my grandmother said, God's in charge. God loves us equally. So I said, tell God to put us in charge from January to June. And to put the white people in charge from July to December.
Yeah.
if what you say is true, if he loves us equally, right, wouldn't that do it for you? Then why can't I ride the merry-go-round? Why do I have to sit in the back of the greasy bus?
So Melba, you went to an all-black elementary school.
Sweetheart, that's a fun question only could be asked by an Irishman. There were nothing other than all-black and all-white schools. They were all separate.
After the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional, for the first time in the United States, black students were legally allowed to attend previously all-white schools. And in Little Rock, Arkansas, originally 116 black children were selected to attend white schools. But due to threats of violence and intimidation from groups like the KKK, most of them opted out. But not all. Melba Beals was one of nine brave teenagers who stepped forward to make that right a reality.
You know, I thought like it was like going to any new school. I had my ponytail. I had really long hair. I always had long hair. I had my ponytail. Grandma had made me polish my saddle shoes brown and white. I thought to myself, just like going to any new school, they may treat us badly at first, but then they'll realize that, you know, we're just as good as they are, and it'll be okay. I never, ever thought that I wouldn't fit in and couldn't go.
This is Little Rock Central High School, approximately 2 hours before the school is scheduled to open its doors.
15-year-old Melba thought it would be like going to any other school, but how wrong she was. The Central High School was huge, with around 1,900 white students. And on the morning Melba and the eight other black teenagers were to enroll, crowds of angry parents started to gather outside the school, along with reporters, who talked about the waving of Confederate flags.
And just moments ago, there was a burst of spontaneous applause as the flag was displayed. From this 500 or 600 persons gathered here, there are approximately 200 National Guardsmen present here on orders of the governor. As yet, there, of course, are no Negroes present.
The 200 National Guards were ordered there by Orville Faubus, the governor of Arkansas, who had called the Supreme Court's decision to integrate a crazy ruling.
Down the United States Supreme Court in its recent crazy ruling.
He put the National Guard in place to try and block the black students from entering, saying it was to protect the peace.
Well, the first day we walked into school, it was absolute hell. The first day was hell. They said the N-word, go home, you know. People were throwing rocks at us and throwing things at us and yelling at us.
Melba's mother was walking her into school. The men grabbed at her. Some had ropes.
They chased us with a rope. She slapped me and told me to go ahead because they actually, one of these guys had a hold of her and she was going to get hanged. I mean, the guy had a hold of her back of her collar and he was holding rope. And this is a whole group of guys that are holding ropes. And she just, for the first time in her life, slapped me and said, you go. And you go now. You run as hard as you can. And I turned around and said, no, not going to leave you.
That must have been horrific, Melba. And what was it like when you actually got inside the school? Because I know that things didn't get that much better. They separated you and the 8 other black students. Why did they do that?
There are 1,900 white students in this huge school. So they said, they were being nasty. They said, you want integration? We're going to give you integration. We're going to send you 9 different ways. So they did.
We talked with Colonel William Page, who is in charge of all guard troops here, asked about turning back any possible Negroes who seek to enter the school. He said each case would be determined independently and separately.
Photographs of the 9 black students, the Little Rock 9, being shouted at, being attacked by a white mob, having armed guards stand next to them, circulated around the US and around the world. And with tensions boiling over, President Dwight D. Eisenhower stepped in.
From the President's office in the White House in Washington, D.C., we present a special address by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. I should like to speak to you about the serious situation that has arisen in Little Rock. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock.
On September the 24th, 1957, the president federalized the Arkansas National Guard, taking it out of the governor's control, and sent in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army to enforce school integration at Little Rock Central High School.
Mob rule cannot be allowed to override the decisions of our courts.
Melba and her classmates endured daily abuse, verbal, physical, and emotional. Some of them eventually had to leave for their safety. But Melba stayed the entire school year.
Here's what I want to really make clear. I don't dislike or hate white people because when I was a little bit older, it would be a white family that would adopt me. And to this day, I have a white family that took me out in California. That's why I'm in California. I came to live with this family called the McCabes. I love my mom and dad. I love that mom and dad were so, he was really the first dad I ever had in my life. And he was McCabe, Irish actually, George McCabe.
I was about to say, that's an Irish name.
Red hair. He was red haired with blue eyes and 6'3" or something, 6'2". And my mom, Carol McCabe, the same. With bangs like my bangs that I have, yeah. And brown hair. I was born
by the river. So Melba, what was it that kept you going throughout high school? Was it a resilience instilled in you from your parents? Was it your faith? What was it that kept you strong during that period?
God, belief in God. The only thing that keeps me going every day of my life, the understanding of my relationship to a higher power has been the task of my life. I'm angry. I'm hurt. I'm sad. But I believe once again, I know that God's above everything. I just have to keep going, putting one foot in front of the other. A change gonna come.
Oh, yes, it will. Finally, Melba, if you could go back and meet your 15-year-old self back then walking into that school, what would you say to her?
It's okay. I had a stomachache. It's okay. God is with you. If you believe in God, it's going to be all right, Melba. And you're going to be surprised when you grow up, because when you grow up, you're going to find out that there's a huge big world out there. And there are places where you'll be welcome and you'll be loved and you'll be cared for. And those places await you if you just get through this.
Well, Dr. Melba Petillo-Beals, it has been a joy talking to you, and thank you so much for your time.
I thank you for wanting to listen. The greatest present you can give anybody else is to listen to them. So to all of your listeners, I say namaste. Thank you for listening.
Colin Flynn was reporting there. He was talking to Melba Petillo-Beals, one of the Little Rock Nine, about her experience of growing up under segregation and stepping into history to defy it as a teenager. I'm joined now in studio by historian Cecilia Hartzell to talk more about this period in the American Civil Rights Movement. Cecilia, you're very welcome back to the History Show.
Thank you so much, Miles.
Now, that dramatic confrontation over the integration of Central High, in which Mrs. Beals and the other students faced violent mobs and had to be escorted by federal troops, it followed the landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. That was a huge development in the fight to end segregation in America. Tell us a little bit about that case and how it came about.
Sure, absolutely. So, first of all, at the time of the Brown decision, before it was passed, the country was still living under the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision from 1896, and that allowed for separate but equal facilities for African Americans. The Brown case itself actually consisted of five local cases of unfair school practices across the District of Columbia and four states. When cases are organized that way in an appeal, they're listed alphabetically, and the decision that's passed is the first case's name. So it was Oliver Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. And Oliver Brown went to court because his daughter, who was a third grader, was forced to walk across railroad tracks to get to a black school a good distance from her house, as opposed to attending a school reserved for white students closer to her house. So that's what the case was about. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, took that case to the Supreme Court. And their argument was that the separate but equal doctrine violated the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And the 14th Amendment, as you probably know, was one of the Reconstruction Amendments. Mm. And it, you hear a lot about it these days because it concerns birthright citizenship. So when that was passed, and that said that any people born in the U.S., including former slaves or naturalized in the U.S., were citizens and they were to be afforded full protection under the law.
Okay. But as we're discovering all over again, courts can make decisions. The decisions have to be enforced. That ruling did not desegregate schools overnight, did it?
No, it was. So there were two rulings. Brown 2 said that the ruling would be enforced with all deliberate speed, which then opened up a window for Southerners then to have delay tactics and to use mob violence to impede that progress. One of the most sort of consequential episodes of that was, I believe it was 1956, 2 years after the Brown decision, the Southern Manifesto was signed by 101 out of 128 Southern congressmen denouncing the decision. And so that gave a permission structure, if you will, to Southern communities to react to violence, with violence and against desegregation.
And did the Brown decision have an impact on a burgeoning civil rights movement in the States?
I think it did. I think the symbolic implications of it, that here is a crack in the wall in segregation, and this is an opportunity then to fight against segregation of schools through the courts. And then symbolically for African Americans, I think it meant that it, once this was on the board, then perhaps this would be extended into other areas of society, again, backed by the courts.
As we heard in the report, it was Eisenhower's decision to use federal power, to send in federal troops, and also, I think, to federalize the Arkansas National Guard, mm-hmm. which had been used in a very different way by the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus. That's what broke the stalemate. But was his hand forced, or was this something that he did willingly?
His hand was forced. Now, personally, it was said that Eisenhower favored a slow but steady progression of civil rights. And as president, he thought that the government should only be involved where it had the authority to do so. So that's where this lull happened in him dealing with this crisis. And ultimately, as he said in an address to the American people, he said, actually, it's not about what I believe. It's not about what anyone believes. It's about upholding the rule of law. And as president of the United States, my role is to make sure that Supreme Court decisions are enforced and federal laws are enforced. He famously said that the two most difficult decisions he ever had to make was one, as the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe during World War II, to issue the go order for the D-Day invasion of Normandy, and two, to send the 101st Airborne down to Arkansas.
Mm, and an Irish weather forecast played a huge exactly. part in the first one, not however, in the second one. Now, all of this is happening against the backdrop of the Cold War and of the use of American hard power, also the use of American soft power. How important do you think the optics of what were going on in the South were important in the context of the Cold War?
Extremely important. I mean, when you think about it, in terms of the Cold War, the product that America had to offer in terms of fighting the Cold War was American democracy. And any kind of tarnishing of that, any kind of understanding that perhaps the rule of law was tarnished by mob rule, that again affected our power, our global power, our global image across the world. And then all those countries that came of age and gained independence after World War II, it became that much harder to convince them not to go communist because, you know, we weren't actually upholding this rule of law.
Now, also in 1957, there was a Civil Rights Act. It was around the same time as the drama was unfolding in Little Rock. That's not a Civil Rights Act that we, I think, hear too much about these days. I mean, civil rights we think of as LBJ, as 1964. How effective a piece of legislation was it?
It wasn't effective. It wasn't implemented in a very effective way. But again, it was another chink in the armor of segregation. That act was about voting rights. And since Reconstruction, since the end of Reconstruction in 1877, the South, even through up to the Civil Rights Acts and Voting Rights Acts in the 60s, the South used intimidation, poll taxes, literacy tests to keep African Americans from voting. And that's what that was about. That was the power of the federal government to get involved to mitigate those circumstances. Again, it paved the way for the 1965 Voting Rights Act, but it wasn't effective as such at the time.
Now, the standoff in Little Rock didn't end in 1957, because in 1958, the governor of Arkansas took what looks like or seems like an extraordinary step, closed all public high schools in Little Rock for the entire academic year, which seems like an act of atrocious self-harm, really. But what impact did that have? What did it do to the controversy?
Well, listen, I like to talk about that time, and because, listen, at that point, you're under 100 years from the end of the Civil War, right? And the public memory of the war was so powerful in the South. And that's what led to this kind of decision. And it's all well and good. Again, this states' rights versus federal power, that echoes from the Civil War, and that was what was still going on. It's all well and good to close the schools, but when they're opened, they then have to comply with the Brown decision. So it was just putting off the inevitable, but very powerful at the time.
Mm. Is what we're seeing now in the USA, do you believe, a regression to the era before Eisenhower did what he did in 1957? In other words, he essentially respected a court decision and intervened. Are we heading backwards? Are we there already?
I think we're there already. I think what I and many people took for granted was that we live in a nation, I lived in a nation of goodwill, right? And that the foundation of American democracy depended a lot upon that goodwill and the respect for law. And if there is neither one of those things, how do you preserve the democracy? So I'm a bit concerned about that. And again, birthright citizenship is raising its ugly head again now.
Well, in 1957, it took 9 brave teenagers, extremely courageous teenagers, a Supreme Court decision and the presidents of the United States to force open the schoolhouse doors. And the fight for equality didn't end there, of course, as we well know. But that's where we leave the story this evening. My guest is historian Cecilia Hartzell. Cecilia, many thanks for joining us again on The History Show.